People first organizations will win in the future of work.
Your only real asset is your people.
We all want purpose-driven work.
HR-led organization is the
future. Sorry, but leaders don't lead empty desks and empty shop floors.
Welcome to the People Strategy Leaders Show. I'm your host, Sri Chalapa, founder and president of Engagedly, and a serial entrepreneur in technology, films, and music. This is where we talk to people leaders, business strategists, and organizational savants about leading in the time of change. What is working, what is not working, and more importantly, what we should be thinking about. Stick around to the end of the show. We will reveal how you can be our next guest. And now, let's engage.
Hello and welcome to People Strategy Leaders Podcast. I am Sri Chalapa, and today I'm joined with Chris Dyer. Chris is a former CEO who has led his companies to be recognized as the best places to work. In addition to being named as the fastest growing company by Inc. magazine 5 times, his profound knowledge in leadership and organizational culture has earned him the title of number one leadership speaker on culture by Inc. magazine. With his 7-pillar strategies, countless companies have unlocked new levels of productivity, performance, and profits. He's also the author of 3 best-selling books, including The Power of Company Culture and Remote Work. Well, welcome to the show, Chris. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Yeah, it's so great to be here, and I'm happy to be on the other side of the mic this time.
Yeah. I remember when I was first starting Engagedly several years ago, I was on your show, and I had a fun time talking to you. At that time, it was more audio and radio. Obviously, things have changed a little bit, but not too much. I do want to talk to you a little bit about the 7-pillar strategy. I'm really curious about that in terms of the 7-pillar strategy of building a strong culture of performance. Can you dive a little deep into what specifically those 7 pillars are? And maybe we can go into more depth into specific ones that have the highest impact.
Sure. And to kind of give everyone a little context, you know, back 2008, 2009, we had a big recession. A lot of my clients were mortgage companies. And so most of them went out of business. And so about 40% of my business dried up, disappeared. People didn't pay their bills. And I'll tell you, I was about to quit. I was about to say, maybe this isn't going to work. Maybe I'm not going to make it. And I was going to maybe just, you know, be done. And I thought there's no way we can overcome all of this. And then I sort of got a little bit more hope and a little bit more gumption and decided, you know, with every problem, with every bit of adversity you face, you know, there's a way forward, and there's growth in there. And that's always been true for me and everything that's happened in my life. And so I decided I'm going to try to figure this out. And there were a couple of big things we had to do. One was, how do we save money, right? How do we have enough cash flow and survive? And one of the things that we came up with was sending everybody home to work. And that saved us a lot of money. But the other thing we had to do was change our culture. It was very imperative to me that we were not running efficiently. We did not have a great culture. We were fine, right? But we weren't attracting the top talent. We weren't retaining top talent. And we certainly were not working and collaborating in a way that anybody from a big company would come in and say, oh, we should do that, right? We were looking at Google and Apple and Facebook and all these big giants and saying, wow, how is it they operate this way? And why aren't we doing that? And so I said, cool, I'm going to change the culture. Well, what am I supposed to change it to? What's the formula? What's the blueprint? What's the answer, right? If you decide you want to do Scrum or Lean or Six Sigma or whatever, there's a very clear structure about what that is. And to my dismay, I realized there was not a book. There wasn't a blueprint. It wasn't something I could just take off the shelf and say, here's what you do to have a great culture. There was a lot of fragmented things out there. And that was, you know, you were on the radio show. That was one of the reasons I started the radio show, was to start having this great dialogue with people to learn. And out of that grew, it was very clear there are 7 pillars or 7 things that every company must do really well in order to have a great company culture. And how you might do it in your company is going to be different than how I do it in my company. Right? There's a lot of variableness, a lot of customization, but we've got to think about seven big areas. So I wonder if there's something you know, in your company that you've identified along the way that, you know, a challenge or an area where you feel like you were weak or maybe you could do a better job. That's really what the seven pillars are trying to address.
Yeah. And, you know, the seven obviously is a good number. But when I think about, you know, what we need to change and what we have to change, and as a SaaS company, you know, a lot of companies went through some level of turmoil last year in the SaaS world, and we were not an exception to that either. So I thought about what are the things we need to change going forward. And there are obviously a few things, but which may be particular to our situation, but broadly speaking, you know, that's probably something we needed to adopt earlier, even if we were not in SaaS. But I'm, you know, eager to hear, and I definitely want to talk more about some of the things that, you know, we are changing to drive a better culture and better performance and better outcomes for our organization. But what are these seven pillars that you uncovered? I would like to go into details on a few of them, on some of them that had the biggest impact.
Yeah. So what's interesting is that the ones that will have the biggest impact are totally dependent upon your company. And so this is the experience that I see every single time. It's that companies hear the seven pillars and there are two or three pillars where they go, you know what? We're pretty good at that. And then there's one they go, it might be a little shaky. And then there's like two or three where they're like, yeah, we're terrible at those. Like that is an area of concern for us. And that's what's cool is that it's not like, hey, you have to do all seven or think about all seven really, you know, well, because you'll have done some just naturally. So I'll walk through kind of quickly here what the seven pillars are, right? And those are, the first one is transparency. The second one is positivity. So positive leadership, focusing on what's working. The third one is listening, right? Making sure our people feel heard. Number four is uniqueness. Number five is recognition. Number six is measurement. And number seven is mistakes, right? How we deal with mistakes in our company. And so I don't know, when you hear those, you might reflect and say, yeah, I got a couple over here I'm good at and a couple over here we could do a better job at. I don't know if you want me just to dive into all of them. If you want to, you know, if you have one there that you heard you want to dive into first.
Yeah, I think the one thing that stands out here is transparency and positivity, actually, as I was writing down these seven pillars. And I know you said you were going through a very tough time. That is when you actually discovered or uncovered these seven pillars. Transparency and positivity is, let's talk about positivity for a second here. Keeping a positive mindset is very important because you want to give people encouragement to keep, you know, climbing that hard road ahead. But at the same time, it can come across as delusional because, mm-hmm. you know, you have all these storm clouds. There's a lot of turmoil. Your clients are leaving you. And you have maybe cash flow issues, you know, you have to let go of some people. At that time, acting positive almost sounds like Don Quixote on a horse. So I want to understand, how do you make sure it is, or how do you do that so it doesn't look like you're just being delusional and essentially lying in some way? And then transparency is another one that I want to dive a little deeper on. How do you keep the level of transparency so that it doesn't scare people? Because if you get too transparent, and it's possible, and I don't know if it is too transparent or not, that's probably something you can add to it. How do you stay transparent enough, but still give people hope? I guess that's where the positivity comes into play. So I like to understand the interplay between these two things.
Yeah. So let's start with the positivity. And you brought up a great point. This is usually the first sort of knee-jerk reaction that people have. I'm not advocating for anybody being sort of this, I'm always positive. Everything is okay. Everything is wonderful. Like while there's a fire in the kitchen, like we're not saying that, right? Positive leadership, or another word for this is appreciative inquiry. It's an entire sort of psychological school where we look at what is working, right? So let's just say your sales team wasn't hitting their numbers, right? And you go in and you look at five salespeople and you got two that are making their number. They're doing really well. And you got one that's doing okay. They're close. And you got two that are really struggling. Where do most leaders put all their attention? They go look at the two that are not doing well, and they spend all their time and energy putting them on pips, trying to motivate them, putting in all their calls, looking at all their emails. They're all over them, right? And that's not helpful to those two people who are struggling, right? They either need to know what to do to do well, or maybe they're the wrong person and we got to let them go, right? Maybe this is not a good job for them. What appreciative inquiry or positive leadership says is, let's go study what the two people who are doing well are doing. What makes them tick? How are they being successful? What are their activities? What are they doing, right? And once we discover that, share that with the rest of the team. Where you focus grows. So if I'm going to focus on what's going well, then we can do more of it. If I'm going to focus on the people that are not doing well, then we're just going to not do well more often, because I'm just muddying the waters, spending all my time poking at people who are not being successful, right? And we often completely forget, right, that our top people could use more support. They could use, often they're like, oh, well, they're doing their thing, let's leave them alone. I'm going to go spend all my time and energy on the two that are terrible. Right. And that is the wrong way to think about it. The best organizations get really fascinated about why those two salespeople are doing well. How do we get them more support? If they're selling in a particular sector or market, could we expand our presence there? Could we put more marketing dollars there? Should we hire more salespeople in that that have that expertise? Those two people that suck, yeah, share. Hopefully they can learn. But if they can't, then let them go. Right. The second way that positive leadership works is that we want to be able to say yes. So as a leader, if my people believe that if they come to me with an idea and I'm going to say yes, yes to hearing them, yes to trying it out, yes to, you know, even exploring the idea, that if my first answer is yes, they're going to come to me with a lot of great ideas. Probably a lot of stupid ideas and a lot of things that will never work, and that's okay, right? But you think about it, if you had a boss, the answer is always no. You just stop trying. You stop bringing them ideas. And unfortunately, as human beings, most people, their natural response is no. You get busy, you get tired, you get hungry, you get whatever, and you get cranky, and people come in the door and you're like, nope. I got time for this. I can't hear this. We tried that last year. Didn't work. I got too much on my plate. No. Those organizations die, right? I'm sure you've read 100 books about why Blockbuster failed, why Kodak failed, why, and all of those leaders were basically no people, right? It wasn't that they all had the idea.
Right.
Blockbuster knew they could do what Netflix did. Kodak knew they could do digital, but they said no. Right, to those new ideas, and it stopped and they never evolved.
So talk about transparency a little bit. So transparency can be scary, right? So if, let's say you just have all these people and you're like, oh, you know what? We lost 30 more customers this week. We may have to let go 20% of our staff in the next month. So that's the level of transparency that you might be talking about. So talk to me a little bit about how transparency helped you. And how should the leaders apply it so it doesn't end up scaring people where the good people leave as well?
Yeah, so I get the fear. I had the fear that, you know, if we told people too much that they would leave, or if things were really good, they would want more money and be asking for raises all the time. And the fear is real. However, I will tell you that in all the years that I went radically transparent with my company, I never had those situations happen. I never had people disappear just because things weren't going well. I never had, you know, a line at my door of people asking me for raises just because we had a few good months. That never happened. And that was because we told them everything. We didn't just tell them the numbers. We talked about everything. We talked about goals. We talked about where we were going. So transparency can go as much or as little as you're comfortable with. And I say, just start off a little, just get transparent, get a little more transparent, and you keep going until you get to that level that you feel like it's working. There are sometimes things that are proprietary, that are confidential, that are, you know, you just can't share. And I get that, right? I mean, if you came to me with a really serious medical issue, I'm not going to go tell the whole company what your medical issue is, right? We can't tell everything. But we started off by telling, there was two areas that we really focused on with transparency that made the most impact. Number one, we started sharing our P&L every month with everybody. And we taught them how
to. How many people did you have in the company?
This was 4,500 people had access to this. Right? These are our employees and independent contractors were all a part of this conversation. Here's how we spend our money. Here's how you read a P&L. This is what this means. What are your questions? They would ask, they would get curious, right? And from that, I got the most amazing ideas. People would go, wait a minute, we're spending how much on this thing? What do you mean? Didn't you know there's this other software that can do the same thing for half the price? Oh, maybe we could take our business and we could push it together and get one or two vendors to do the work instead of having 15 vendors do the work, and we could get a cost savings, right? What do you mean we spend that much on health insurance? Like they started getting really curious and coming back and saying, why aren't we doing it this way or that way? And sometimes we would, well, that's the best way we could come up with doing it. And sometimes, wow, that's a great idea. Why don't you get a group of people, get a committee? Why don't you go and try to see if you could help save us money? We were never more profitable than after we started telling people how we're spending the money. Because I had more eyeballs, I had more people thinking about it. And every day they made tiny little micro decisions to save us money because they wanted to see that number get better.
Yeah.
We set profitability goals, all that stuff, right? And they benefited from that in the long run, but not in the short run. We didn't like give out little bonuses or, you know, some companies can do this, but we didn't tie their pay to any of that stuff because there were times when it went to total hell, right? It was just like our P&L's complete mess. We've had no profitability for 3 months. We lost a couple clients. We had to invest it in this software. We added some more people. But we talked about it and they understood what we were doing. They understood what the vision was, right? The other thing we did that made a really big impact was to share everyone's goals with everybody. I can't tell you how many times I've walked in, I've had companies come to me and say, you know, hey, my senior team's struggling. Can you work with us? Or this team's struggling. Can you work with them? And it's usually a goals problem. That's the first problem we get into. Before the personality stuff, before the alignment, I find out that your goals are not in alignment with my goals. And the CEO didn't do it on purpose, but like, you know, negotiations happen at different times. And like you, let's say as the head of sales, can't possibly reach your goals. And me as the head of marketing or me as the head of customer service can't reach my goal. We both can't get there the way they're set up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're not in alignment. And we're automatically set up to now fight, right? And be at each other's throats for resources and time and all this other stuff. So when we started sharing everyone's goals, we realized it was misalignment and we started getting aligned, making sure we changed goals so we all could win, we all could go forward, right? And we all could support each other. And then I could help you be successful and you could help me be successful. And we were comrades, not competitors. Right? We're working together in the same company. And so that kind of transparency just it completely changed everyone's perspectives. They understood what their boss's goals were, their team members understood each other's goals were, what they were working on, and they all just started helping each other. Right? In the way in which you would have thought they would before, but they didn't know how to help each other. They didn't know what each other's goals were, right? And they didn't understand the resources and how the company was actually functioning and working.
Yeah. You know, that's a very important thing. There's two things I wanted to add to that. A lot of days when I look at my role as CEO, I think my role should be changed to be called CAO, Chief Alignment Officer.
Yeah.
The whole time I'm trying to align people on their goals and reiterate why we're doing it, why the dependencies matter, because what you do affects this team and what you do affects that team, and getting everybody aligned together. And that's very, very important. The second thing around transparency is that you talked about getting the goals publicly available, right? So everybody's goals are public. Obviously, we use our own software, Engagely, which is a goal tracking software as well, where you can set up OKRs and goals and everybody can see everybody else's goal depending on how you set up the system. And I think that's been a big, big change. I think a lot of companies can see if they actually did that, because there's no reason to hide the goals unless there's some kind of a, you know, if you're putting somebody on a PIP or there are some really financial level, you know, confidential data in the goals, maybe you don't want to talk about that. You know, if your goal is to reduce staff by 20%, I don't know if that's something you want to necessarily announce upfront at that point publicly. Maybe that's a discussion to be had more subtly and thoughtfully with the rest of the organization. So in terms of your, when you started doing that, like what are some of the, did you face resistance from people in sharing their goals? Or did you feel like there was full buy-in into the process from your people?
I would say the resistance was by my senior team to actually tell everyone about the P&L. They were very afraid. They were very scared. And I was like, we're going to do it. You know, I've seen other companies do this. I've seen them be very successful. We're going to try it. And we started with just, here's what our sales were. Here's what our expenses were. Here's what our profit was, right? And it's talking about it. And then we started expanding and teaching. And eventually, here's a full P&L, right? Which most people don't know how to read a P&L, right? And so we had to give them education and help make sure they understood what they were looking at. And we would give it to them in advance. They could come to the meeting with their questions, with their thoughts, right? And then we would break out during the month, and then they would work on ideas and new things. And they would come back a month later and be like, this is what we came up with. This is how we think we can make that number better. As far as goals, I didn't really care if they were worried about it. I was like, this is the change. And I don't know if that's right or wrong, but I was like, we're going to start being radically transparent around here, and everyone's goals are going to be public. We're going to put everyone's goals on a sheet. We're going to put them in a bucket, and we're not going to have any goals that are not good for people. So to your point, those goals I'm talking about are positive goals. What are the things we expect them to do, whether KPIs or things that are part of their job? If somebody was on a PIP, if somebody was struggling, and maybe there are some, those types of things that they'd be working on with their managers specifically, and that wouldn't necessarily be public knowledge. But we're talking about what are those things that we expect from them as that employee in that role. And then we started taking the responsibility off of the leader to help that person reach their goals, and instead put the responsibility to the team to help each other reach their goals. Right. So the most important goals were the team goals. Team goals were our most, did our team reach their goals? That was my measurement of success. Then did you as an individual reach your goals? Because your team could do spectacularly well, and if you just missed your goals, but your team did really, really well, I'm going to assume that you are helping your team. I'm going to assume you are a part of that success. And I'm not going to fire you or demote you or take whatever, because the team did spectacular, but you were just below what we expected, right? How do we help you be more successful next time? But sometimes, I mean, if anyone's ever watched any sort of sports, there's a bunch of people, you know, are really good players who do really special things that are not tangible statistics, right? You know, let's just use basketball. Somebody can box out and make sure somebody else doesn't get a rebound. Their teammate may get the rebound every time. They get the stat. But right, we know that other person had a big part in making their team successful, right? Playing very good defense is hard to put a stat on, right? Mm-hmm. So there's these intangibles. And so we have to make sure that we're open to that. So again, team goal first. If you win the championship, you win all of the games, are you going to go back to someone and say, well, you were supposed to have 10 points a game, you only had 8? No.
Yeah.
No, that's silly, right?
Yeah, there's one other item in your seventh pillar. One of the pillars that stood out for me is around mistakes. Can you talk a little bit about that pillar and specifically how should a leader implement specifically that pillar?
Yeah, so a few things. There's mistakes and there's errors. So errors are when we are multitasking, we're going too fast, we're not properly trained, we're careless, we don't care, right? We're apathetic to results. Those behaviors are not okay. And I'm not advocating that you accept those. Mistakes are, I'm going to try something new. I thought this was the right thing to do, and I really believed it. And I, with everything I knew, I went and did it. And now new information came in, and we realized that was the wrong thing. And so we can change and do the right thing the next time. That's the difference, right? You know, Dyson is famous for, I don't know, making a mistake 5,962 times or something before he finally got the right combination for his vacuum to work properly, right? We wouldn't call him a failure. We would call him a success, but he failed almost 6,000 times before he got there, right? So mistakes are about trying and trying and trying and doing the right thing. Now, if you look at Scrum and Agile, and there are other methodologies that do this, there's an intentional meeting called, like in Scrum, it's called the retrospective,
right?
Where you get together after a project and you say, what did we do well? What could we have done better? Where did we screw up? Like, where could we, you know, what did we thought was going to work, but didn't work out very well? And we should change that next time, right? We want those ideas and those things to be front and center. In fact, we should be celebrating those mistakes. We should be high-fiving them, thanking them, rewarding them. I used to have a oops, my bad room in Slack. And people would go in there and admit the things they tried, the mistakes they made, so that everyone else could learn from them. And leaders have to start this process. Leaders have to be the ones showing everyone it's okay to admit this, because when leaders start saying they made mistakes and they screwed up, then employees feel safe to do the same thing, right? We can't just tell employees, tell us how you screwed up. We promise you won't be in trouble. And then leaders never do it. That doesn't work, right? And then I would give out in our monthly meeting, I would give out an award and like a little gift card or something to the you know, for the boo-boo of the month award, right? Whoever made the biggest mistake, whoever was the bravest, whatever was the coolest thing they tried, like whatever it was, I would recognize someone. Thank you for telling us. Thank you for trying, and make it a positive thing. The benefit of that is that these little mistakes and these little attempts to do something better don't just live in secrecy, right? Because sometimes that's bad and there are things happening in your company you need to know about. And sometimes there's really good learnings there. Somebody would be like, oh, you tried that and it didn't work. But did you know if you just made this little switch here, that could actually work? And that would be better and more profitable and faster, or help the client or whatever it may be. But that stuff has to get out into the company, has to be transparent in order for us to take advantage of it and be a success, or just to help people get better at their jobs, right?
Yeah. Well, you have a second edition of a book coming out. Can you talk about a little bit about that book? And I also want to understand a little bit about your thoughts on how the work is changing from the times, you know, in the 2000s, 2010s, and now obviously we're living in the post-COVID era, which is almost like a mile marker, if you will, in our journey in our workplace. What is changing, and how, and what is your book about? Maybe that's addressing that as well.
Sure. So to your point, so much has changed. And so I took my first book, which I was really proud to have been a bestseller, The Power of Company Culture. And I really almost doubled the book, right? So expanded all of the content, added tons more case studies with NASA, with Gary Vaynerchuk's company, VaynerMedia, Neiman Marcus, some other big names. We went in and I did some case studies with them to kind of really see what they're doing today, right, with the pillars, and how they're using them and their company. So there's a lot more. It's just really expanded the content and try to talk about some of the things that we can be taking advantage of or we should be thinking about right now and give you a few of those. The first is, if you're not taking advantage of flexible work at some level in your company, and I understand are some companies where that's impossible, but for most companies, allowing some flexible work is a true advantage. It is a true positive thing that you should be able to do to retain top talent, to get more work done. Now, you want to be 100% remote? Cool. You want to be hybrid twice a week? Fine, right? Whatever that combination is, that's up to you and your company. But allowing people to work from home on a Monday because they got to take their kid to the doctor for an hour, as opposed to taking an entire day off because they have to take their kid to the doctor, is a win for you and a win for them, right? Not having to sit in traffic for 2 hours each way because on Fridays the traffic is terrible and instead they work from home. It's a win for everyone, right? There are so many advantages to that. And for me, having peace and quiet to work on my stuff and not have people in my office as the CEO every single day is huge. Again, every company is different, but so flexible work is something that is a real shift. Obviously, it's post-pandemic that really sped that process up. It democratized work for the average employee. Second thing is noise, right? Just think about, I remember when I was starting work, there were like people doing classes on learn Microsoft Word, learn Excel, right? Learn this coding language. Like it was like no one knew how to do this stuff. And within a few years, it was just expected. When you got a job, you were expected to know how to use Word or Excel or program in a certain language. We're not training you on the job. You better already know how to use that stuff, right? And so here we are again with AI, and we're teaching people about how to use AI. And in a couple of years, it's going to be, you better know how to do prompting. You better know how to use this program to be able to do your job. And so there's this like leveling up that needs to happen with people that we're going to have to do or they're going to have to do. But there's so much noise right now. And this is what most companies are struggling with, is how do we help our teams navigate the noise to really help them be a high-performing team? It's often what I'm spending a lot of my time doing keynotes on or helping training teams on, is to really come up with strategies to sift through the noise, focus on what's working, you know, knowing where to focus to get their best outcomes, best outputs, so their teams can be happy, healthy, so that the company can have high performance, high productivity, and most importantly, high profits, right? And not high profits because they're taking advantage of their employees or the market, but high profits because they're doing a great job and they're being smart about their business in a moral and ethical way. So those are some of the big themes. I think there's some big multi-generational things happening. And if you want to talk about it, resiliency is one of the most interesting sort of polar opposite opinions that we're seeing right now amongst the different generations.
Why don't we spend a minute on resiliency? Specifically, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so what we're seeing is that the older generations, and let's start with millennials and then go older, they are saying, you need to be resilient. You know, it's work is tough. Things happen. You got to put in your best work. You got to fight through all of the frustrations and all of a pandemic and a recession. And you just got to suck it up, buttercup, and be more resilient. I mean, that's essentially the message. And they're saying, that's what I had to do. And that's what you need to do, Gen X, Gen Z, the ones that below them. However, the younger generations are adamantly saying, I am sick and tired of being told to be more resilient.
Interesting.
I'm exhausted with this term. And you're not giving me the support. You're not giving me the help. You're not giving me the pay. You're not giving me anything that I need to be able to try to be more resilient or want to be more resilient, right? And there's a big generational shift of like, hey, I don't need to be more resilient. If I can't come to my job, do my thing, be good at what I'm supposed to do, and then go home to my family or do whatever I want to do, I'm going to go somewhere else, right? This job is not going to kill me. This job is not going to be my entire life. And I'm not going to take my work home and work all weekend and be more resilient, try to get some project done just because that's what the company wants. And it's a change, right? In mindset. When I was like 20 something, if you told me you can make $100,000 a year, but you got to go clean porta potties, like I would have said, cool, I'll go do that for a couple of years. I'll save every dollar I have. I'll go start a business after that. I'll go buy a home. Like I'd do anything. But when I talk to my kids and younger generations, I pose them with that question. They're like, absolutely not. I want to do something that I love to do. I want to work for a company that I respect. I want to work for a boss that I admire. What they want out of work is very, very different. And whether that's right or wrong, or whether you agree with it or not, it doesn't matter. That's what they're saying on average. We're seeing that consistently in survey data and exit interview data, you know, hundreds of thousands of responses, consistently seeing that message. And so leaders and teams have to deal with that reality for the future of work if they want to be successful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks, Chris. That was very insightful. I do agree there's a big generational shift. And I don't know if it is necessarily universal. There are obviously exceptions. You know, I've seen Gen Zs and younger generation be more like the millennials and Gen Xers. And then they're the ones who are the opposite. You know, I see that across the board. But broadly speaking, we are all seeing that shift. Whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, I guess only time will tell. But I guess as humans, we weren't necessarily always meant to constantly work, although work gives me a lot of pleasure and satisfaction and stress a lot of times as well, but that's what we signed up for. So with that, thanks a lot, Chris. It was a pleasure talking to you. And again, the name of the book is?
The Power of Company Culture, the second edition. It's the orange cover. If you're not sure, if you're looking on Amazon or something, it's the orange cover, not the yellow one. The yellow one's the old one. Although you can buy whichever one you like, but the orange one is better. So,
excellent. Well, thanks, Chris.
Awesome. Thank you.
Sri Chalapa here. Thank you so much for listening to the People Strategy Leaders podcast. If you are a successful leader or a people strategist who would like to be on this program, please visit engagedly.com/People Strategy Leaders podcast. If you got something out of this interview, would you share this episode on social media? If you know someone that would be a great guest, tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag People Strategy Leaders. I love seeing your posts and guest suggestions. We are regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you don't miss any episodes, go ahead and subscribe. Your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show and mean a lot to me and my team. Want to know more? Follow me on LinkedIn and Twitter at Sri Chalapa. Thanks for listening. We will see you next time. And thank you to Patrick Ramsey, sound engineer at Kalinga Production Studios, for recording and mixing this show.